joining me today in conversation is somebody whose work I've read for a long time, watched for a long time, whether it be on the stage at TED or otherwise. John Ronson. He is a acclaimed journalist, the author of several books you may have heard of, including Them, The Men Who Stare at Goats, So You've Been Publicly Shamed, and a whole lot more that, you know, I think just for time's sake, we won't be able to get into. John, thanks for joining today.
My pleasure, Jared. Nice to meet you.
A little bit of backstory here. This was probably 3 or 4 years ago. I've been covering sort of the extremist right for a long time. And, you know, one of my editors was leaving their job and going to a new one and cleaning out their office. And they handed me your book, Them, Adventures with Extremists, and said, hey, you might like this. So, you know, I thumbed through it and was just instantly consumed. And the approach that you took in that book has informed so much of my own work. This, like, balance of humor, whether it's, like, joining Alex Jones as they go try to get into Bohemian Grove, or it's, you know, but also balancing that with, like, kind of an appropriate amount of skepticism and scrutiny, without missing kind of the humanity of it all. So, you know, before we dive into it, I just want to, you know, throw that out there and ask you, you know, it's been nearly 20 years since you've published Them, and a lot has changed, to say the very least.
Yes.
You know, when you think about the way you were covering these extremists and conspiracy theorists back then, you know, I guess I'm just curious your reflections on the, what is it, 19, 20 years or so since Them was published. You know, what are your thoughts in the way that everything has developed into this modern day?
Well, I think that the reason, like the starting point of Them, I guess, was I think I noticed something that everyone knows now, but very few people knew back then, which was that there was a relationship between political and religious extremism and conspiracy theories. What had happened was I'd spent a year with making a TV documentary with Omar Bakri Mohammed of Al-Muhajirun, who's now in solitary confinement in Beirut for inspiring acts of terrorism. And it was one of his people who said to me, did you know that there's a shadowy cabal secretly ruling the world from inside a secret room called the Bilderberg Group? And then I was with the Ku Klux Klan about a year later in Arkansas, a politically correct faction of the Ku Klux Klan. And they said the same thing to me. They said, there's this group called the Bilderberg Group. So that seems so odd. I would have thought that some militant Islamists in London and a clan in the Ozarks would have nothing much in common, but they had this one very arcane thing in common. Now, 20 years later, it's consumed the world. Alex Jones, who I was one of the very first people to interview, I think, in that book, and as you say, snuck into Bohemian Grove with him. And I used to joke that I was Alex Jones's Simon Cowell. But that joke kind of stopped being funny about 5 or 6 years ago, so or more, about 8 or 9 years ago, when he really got a lot. I mean, he was always a difficult person, but he got significantly worse.
Right.
So they took over the world. Alex has had Trump's ear. Trump went on his show. Trump, but I think more significantly than that, Trump just is the kind of person you'd see in an Alex Jones audience or a David Icke audience. He's one of those people who believes all of that stuff, you know, whether it comes from narcissism. Sometimes I think it comes from narcissism, that, you know, narcissists want to be the smartest people in the room. And if that means coming up with a whole different set of facts, then they'll just do it because they don't care about what's true and what's not.
Right. If you create like an alternative reality that differs from the rest of the world, you get to be the expert on what you've invented.
you're smarter than everyone else, and you're not encumbered by remorse that you're not telling the truth because you're more important than the truth. So I don't think it's really any coincidence that the way Trump is unraveling right now is very similar to the way that Alex Jones unravels when things are going badly for him. And by unraveling, I suppose what I mean is doubling down. It's like the opposite of unraveling. It's like becoming more and more committed to your narrative.
Right. So as things have, you know, as they're doubling down, as you put it, you know, it seems that, you know, most of the United States, when you look at polling and whatnot, you know, they aren't on board with this. This is still like a political fringe, but that fringe has really grown in size, or in the very least in sympathy. Mm. People are like, well, you know, it's considered like a reasonable point of view. And I'm curious, if you wrote them today, would you have approached it differently? You know, the way you write about these extremists and conspiracy theories is like, there's this big assorted cast of just like very strange, peculiar characters that are like bumbling off in the middle of the woods, or like, you know, in outside like government buildings in London or whatever. Just like, you know, yeah. they're kind of cranks, right? But there's a common theme among them. But, you know, if you were to kind of approach the book today, do you think your approach, or, you know, the way that you would have written about it would have been any different? Do you think that, you know, the landscape has changed so much it warrants a different sort of look at it?
Yes. Well, I wouldn't write the book today, I think probably for two main reasons. First, everyone's writing those. I wouldn't want to be in competition. Like, I always get very nervous when I'm on a story that other people are on. So I feel very fortunate that I identified this as a growing concern when other people hadn't. So that's one reason. And the other reason is that I always felt very fortunate that I finished the book just before 9/11. Because after 9/11, conspiracy theorists became just so unpleasant. It, you know, the truthers. I did a story about a woman. I did a story in 2005 about a woman called Rachel North, who was a victim of the London tube bombings. And she became a spokesperson for the survivors. And all of these conspiracy theorists just refused to believe that she existed. And the more she tried to convince them that she existed, the more they were adamant that she didn't. And it became very hostile. They started, like, you know, really, really going after this woman who'd just been blown up on the tube. And so all of these, like, really awful, inhuman acts were happening in the world of conspiracies after 9/11. And that, I think that would have made, you know, the shoes on my feet very leaden, and the book wouldn't have had the lightness that I really like. So I think for those two reasons, I wouldn't write that book today. There's other things within the conspiracy and extremist world that are totally mystifying and fascinating to me, which maybe I would still write about.
Like what do you see out there today that you know, would be curious to kind of unpackage?
The way that people seem to tumble down rabbit holes so effortlessly. There's no work involved, and it feels like somebody will wake up in the morning as they're just a regular, normal person, and if they fall down the wrong rabbit hole, by that night, they're seeing the world completely differently. And it's, you know, people talk about the algorithms, and some people say, oh, well, they're just not very clever. They, you know, these boomers can't really tell the difference between truth and fiction, and that's why they fall for these conspiracy theories. But these all feel like kind of shallow explanations.
Right. And it discounts that, you know, at least maybe I'm naive, but I like to think that most people aren't stupid.
And
you know, when I've been at events and rallies, talking to different extremists, interviewing them for stories, et cetera,
yeah,
a lot of these people aren't, you know, I have kind of struggled to describe this without people, you know, accusing me of sympathizing with a fascist or something. But it's something, it's like stupidly smart, right? It's like smart people that are addicted to stupid things or stupid ideas. They're very intelligent on a stupid, dumb concept.
Yes, and you know, they consider themselves moral, and yeah, you know, I've always been a very big believer in not going into any situation with preconceptions. So again, if you're going into a situation, you think, oh, well, they just believe this stuff because they're stupid. You're never going to get an interesting story. You're never going to get any revelations. You're never going to try and see the world through their eyes, and all the important things that you can do if you go into a situation without those preconceptions. I heard a really great podcast the other day, which was so interesting about extremism. I don't want to name it because I'm about to criticize it, and I don't want to sort of be mean about people. But it did that thing that we talked about. It was like they started talking about QAnon people, and they sort of said, "Well, they're just not very clever," and then they moved on, and it really marred. And otherwise, that's just such a. It felt like a kind of thoughtless brush off, yeah, as opposed to, you know, finding a way of thinking deeper about it. So for all of those reasons, I certainly wouldn't have written them again, but I am really pleased I did write it when I did.
So on the topic of Alex Jones, you mentioned earlier, you know, you used to make the joke that you were his Simon Cowell. You had discovered Alex Jones for the world. In modern times, especially, I think in the last 4 years, when I've been, you know, doing work on this beat or this topic, there's been all this conversation about platforming. Are you platforming somebody? Mm. Are you making something a thing? As far as your coverage of Alex Jones, I'm just curious. You know, it has been some time, and I of course don't want to, you know, be like John. Oh, you hate Alex Jones? Well, John Ronson's the reason. You know, you know, I don't want to insinuate anything silly like that. But do you have, you know, seeing Alex Jones kind of blossom into this like cultural like icon of sorts, and then, you know, he's kind of since fallen off the maps from getting kicked off of things. Do you have any like regrets about covering Alex Jones? Or, you know, you made that joke and you said it got a lot less funny. So I guess I'm just kind of curious what your thoughts are looking back.
Well, I think I redressed any balance that needed to be redressed about a year ago, because I think I probably did feel, well, it's too postmodern to say, like, why did you present Alex Jones in this way when he doxes parents of children killed at Sandy Hook? But of course, that hadn't happened. Alex was a different person when I spent so much, all the time that I did with him. His shtick was very much about the New World Order, globalization, everything's an inside job. 9/11 was an inside job. Oklahoma City was an inside job. He wasn't, you know, I've said this once or twice in the past, and no one's told me I'm wrong. I'm really happy to accept I'm wrong if something comes up which I don't know about. But he wasn't racist, to my knowledge, back then. He wasn't Islamophobic. He felt less malevolent than he became. I think a few things happened. Somebody came along and said to Alex, I don't think Alex was very rich until relatively recently. And then somebody came along and said, you know, I can make you a lot of money by you're selling, you know, male vitality supplements and stuff like that. And so he started doing these pledge, you know, these drives where he'd sell these supplements, and he'd make up to, I've been told, up to $100,000 a day. So he suddenly became very rich, more popular. He gets Trump's ear. And it just turned, the whole thing just sent him spiraling, and he just became increasingly dangerous.
Right.
And unpleasant. But he wasn't like that when I was with him.
Yeah, I think the earliest extremist profiles that came out from him, from places like Southern Poverty Law Center and whatever, classified him as like a anti-government extremist.
Right.
Right. It wasn't like that. If you asked me who Alex Jones was today, I'd be like, oh, well, this is a guy who just has like white nationalists like rotate through the studio and like weird wants to be QAnon, but just can't make himself say it. Like, you know, just.
Yeah. Yes. That's how he felt to me. And at the time, I was hanging out with, you know, I was spending time with the Ku Klux Klan, and I went to Aryan Nations, and I spent time with Randy Weaver. So, you know, I spent time with white supremacists, the Klan, and I would have put Alex in a very different category to that. But I feel like I did redress the balance about a year ago, because the fact is Alex did turn into a more nefarious character, and my story about him when we snuck into Bohemian Grove together was such a kind of defining story. I did feel like I had to do something to redress the balance. So I did a story for This American Life about Alex's childhood. I don't know if you've heard it. You're looking like you may not have.
I think I saw it come out. But I don't know that I've listened to it.
Right, it's pretty good. It's kind of interesting. What happened was, I was at the Republican convention in 2016, and there was this sweet kid called Josh Owens, who was Alex Jones's cameraman. But I noticed over the week of the Republican convention that he seemed to prefer spending time with me than with Alex. I kept on bumping into Josh, and we kept hanging out, and then, you know, Alex would call him, and like Josh would like roll his eyes and have to go off and, you know, spend time with Alex. And so I got the sense that he wasn't happy being with Alex.
Right.
And then I think I texted him and sort of said, if there's ever anything that you want to say to me about Alex, you know, I'm right here. And he did. I met him on the eve of Trump's inauguration at a hotel in D.C. And he wanted to meet me, but he didn't tell me why he wanted to meet me. But I got the sense that he wanted to be a kind of whistleblower, an Alex Jones whistleblower. But as our conversation went on, I realized that he didn't really have anything particular to whistleblow about. He just wasn't happy. Like, he used to be such a big Alex Jones fan, but now he works for Alex. It's such a nightmare. Alex would like pull down Venetian blinds and, you know, make him lie, make him go to like Islamberg in upstate New York, and make it sound an awful lot worse than it was, and so on. But then he said to me, he said, I do. There is a story that I've heard that nobody knows about Alex. I've only heard it from family members, and not even people who work for InfoWars know this story. And the story is that when Alex was at school, he was a bully. And a lot of the kids that he bullied just got sick of it and lured him to a party in a barn. But it was a trap, and they beat him within an inch of his life. And that's why he left Dallas and moved to Austin and became a conspiracy theorist, because he'd been the victim of a conspiracy. These kids had, like, And he wanted to be the person who knew what other people didn't. And all of this was at odds with Alex's own origin story, which was the reason why he left Dallas and moved to Austin, was because he uncovered police corruption. And the cop said to him, if you don't leave,
I'm sure.
Yeah. Now, what do you think about those two stories? Which seems the more plausible? So I went off to Rockwall, which is a suburb of Dallas, to try and find the kids who did or didn't beat Alex within an inch of his life. And I did find one of them. Alex had nearly killed him. He'd beaten this guy unconscious over nothing, over like a girl, to the extent that he's still disabled from it. And he was one of the people who then got Alex to the party and, you know, beat the shit out of Alex. The story was basically true, but there was this sort of sad twist at the end of it, which is that he didn't realise that Alex had become, for some reason, he didn't know that Alex had become the famous Alex Jones. So I said to him, oh, you know, Trump's a fan now. And he just looked heartbroken.
Oh my God.
that his enemy from school was like, Trump was a fan. And I said, and you know, all the stuff, because the thing that Josh had got wrong was that Alex was already a conspiracy theorist. It wasn't this experience that turned him that way. But the way that Alex's conspiratorial belief manifested in high school was like, oh, the guy who runs the pool hall is in league with the headmaster, and they're both in league with the DEA, and so on. So I said to this guy, I said, you know, so now Alex is going on about, you know, the Muslims and the Mexicans, but it's no different to how he was at high school. You know, in high school, it was all about the pool hall, and now it's about the Muslims and the Mexicans, but it's the same thing. Can't you see it's the same thing? And this guy went, well, maybe Obama is a Muslim. It's like he couldn't go that one extra step and say, right, like, I know Alex is full of shit, but even though Alex is the one who's like, you know, passing a lot of this conspiratorial nonsense to Trump, he had to still believe it because Trump had said it.
Right.
It was a melancholy look at, you know, how people are, as I said before, like committed to their narratives.
Right.
I said to him, you more than anyone should know.
Right.
And
No kidding.
Yeah.
Kind of moving on, in them, there's this concept that's reoccurring, which is the existence, and you mentioned this a little bit earlier, the existence of like a room where it happens. And like throughout the book, you're like trying to find the room. It's 2020 now. Have you found the room, John? is that where I see you in right now?
Yeah, maybe we're in the room.
I should explain for people who are unfamiliar, the concept of the room where it happens being that whether it is the Bilderberg Group, the New World Order meeting and orchestrating the fate of the world, like surely when these conversations are happening, there must be like a meeting room somewhere where this is happening. Or like, is it at the G20 summit? Is it at Bilderberg? Is it at Bohemian Grove? Like theoretically, all of these people would need to like jump in. You know, this is before Skype and Zoom calls, but
yeah,
we'd have to like get together in a meeting room somewhere and like plot this nefarious action, you know?
Yeah, and I tried, when I was writing them, I tried to sneak into the Bilderberg meeting and got chased by their henchmen or stroke security guards. But I did successfully get into Bohemian Grove with Alex. So I did sort of get into the room, but I'm not sure how much that's the room. But maybe the answer to that is like, there's lots of little rooms. Like,
that's what I was going to get at is, you know, this concept of like thinking about the room has helped me understand conspiracy theories in kind of a very like innate way, where if I listen to, for example, like last night at a rally, Trump is talking about this like voter fraud that was orchestrated. And it's like, okay, well, was there like, how would this have to work? like all George Soros and the Republican governor of Georgia and Dominion voting systems all get in like a Zoom call and they talk about how they're going to swing the election. Like, you know, it just kind of, you know, recognizing how absurd it all is, you know.
Yeah, but there are little rooms. Over the past 4 years, I never missed. Like, I got obsessed with Trump. I felt like a constant preparedness. Not that I would know necessarily what I would personally do if a civil war began, but I was constantly outraged and constantly in preparedness for, you know, the horror that America was becoming under Trump, which one way that manifested itself was I never missed an Anderson Cooper monologue and I never missed a Rachel Maddow monologue. I used to joke that, you know, they're my cue. I would believe anything that Anderson Cooper said to me, but I really laughed. I can't remember. I was watching CNN one night not so long ago, and after 4 years of like completely righteous and appropriate constant attacking Trump, they ran a story about how Kamala's husband had leapt over a crash barrier and saved somebody from being like suffocated in the audience. And they were so, and I thought, well, in a way, you know, that's kind of a little room, right? That there was a sense of absolutism. Like Trump was absolutely terrible. Kamala and her husband saving somebody from being, was absolute, you know, so there are little rooms. And you know, the thing that people tend to say about conspiracy theorists is that they come up with these theories because the truth about the world is so frightening that nobody controls anything, everything's just random. And that's such a frightening thing to think of, that they create these conspiracies for reasons of comfort. And I'm sure there's a lot of truth to that, but also you get renaissances of conspiracy theories when our leaders behave in conspiratorial manners.
Right. A lot of conspiracy theories, you know, something is that there are perfectly good reasons to distrust the government, you know?
And also we succumb. I mean, until Louise Mensch started saying things on Twitter that obviously were wrong.
I take no pleasure in reporting
that Steve Bannon is about to be executed, arrested and executed. But for a while, right? I mean, I don't know about you, but, you know, I was like, until it was obvious that she was saying things that weren't true, I was kind of hooked. Were you?
I was for a short time, very quickly, I'm not a huge fan of the like Twitter thread format. So after a while, when I saw like thread, I'd just be like, I don't have time for this. I'd skip it after a while.
Absolutely. But I do think, you know, we on the left are definitely, I think, better at spotting bullshit than people on the right. And we pretty much realized as soon as Louise Mensch went off the rails that she was going off the rails. So her moment in the sun didn't last very long. But her moment in the sun was a moment in the sun when we were all so shocked by Trump's election that we kind of became conspiracy theorists.
Right, we were searching, you know, kind of the what you were saying about the kind of attribution for conspiracy theories, where it's like we're trying to figure out how this happened because it seemed so impossible to happen.
Right. And, you know, Rachel Maddow was going to give us all the answers. And so, you know, our thought process, I think, kind of echoed the people who we scrutinize.
Right. So, you know, and that kind of brings me to sort of the last thing I want to ask you about them before we talk about your experience with So You've Been Publicly Shamed. And that is that, you know, conspiracy theories and conspiratorial thinking is not a exclusively partisan thing. A lot of my work in the past has focused on right-wing extremism. particularly because it is more potent, and especially in the last 4 years, we had a president who was kind of embodying that and, you know, kind of making this cultural force that it hadn't been, you know, to that level before. But, you know, as we think about the little rooms and the conspiracy theories and everything, you know, for the average listener of this podcast or something who's maybe just listening to us talk on their drive to the supermarket or something like that, you know, what do you think the average person should make of this? Or, you know, especially a question I get a lot that I've never been quite sure how to answer is if a loved one, mm-hmm. like a family member or a friend, is falling down these rabbit holes and getting caught up in this extremist narratives or conspiracy theories, what's the average person to do, or what's the average person to think?
The kind of epidemic of people falling down the rabbit hole is comparatively new. So, I mean, the number of people who are falling down the rabbit hole is comparatively new. So I think there isn't... I'm not sure that there's like a set of rules have formed just yet. I would quite like to do that as research, to try and figure out, like, how do you... Is there a set of rules where you can de-radicalise somebody in that way? Like, in fact, I'm sort of a little bit of the way down that road now. I know there's certain things that you shouldn't do. You shouldn't confront them. You shouldn't engage with them on the quote-unquote evidence, because you won't win that way.
Right.
Because they just believe, like they're just convinced. There are the Podesta emails and so on. I suppose I can't answer the question fully. I hope to be able to answer the question fully sometime. But I would say that don't engage with them on the facts. But what you can do, perhaps, is engage with them on the emotions. You know, they love Q.
Right.
Like, you know, it's their head over heels in love with Q. So maybe that's the way to think about it. Mm. Think of it as an emotional thing, not a factual thing. I don't know if that helps. That maybe helps, might help a little bit.
Yeah, I like you said, this phenomena is pretty recent, and it's my hope. I can't, you know, honestly say I'm really aware of the like psychological academia or any progress that's been made there. But, you know, it's hard for me to imagine that somewhere somebody who is more credentialed or more studied than I is thinking about this, and maybe one day we'll get a answer. It'll be like some like delicious BuzzFeed article that's like, these 5 steps will make your grandma stop believing in Q.
Wouldn't it be terrible if somebody does come to a perfect conclusion and that's the way they present their findings as a listicle?
All right. So another great book you wrote, this one more recent, I think, if I remember right, this is like 2015, 2016?
Yeah, it came out in 2015.
Yeah, So You've Been Publicly Shamed is a book about people who have had their lives upended from getting publicly shamed online.
Yeah.
And the story that in talks and presentations that I've watched of yours that you tell most often, at least from what I've seen, is that of Justine Sacco.
Yeah.
She's a woman who tweeted out a tasteless joke. The internet decided it was racist. You spoke to her. The intention was not racist. Of course, you know, it was definitely ham-fisted and in poor taste, in my opinion. I don't think that's really up for debate.
Not at all.
But you know, it wasn't that she was this like sinister racist person.
No.
Can you walk us through the spark notes of the Justine Sacco story for anybody who might not be familiar?
Sure. It's funny. I must have told like 1,000 stories over my years as a journalist, and this is the story that people want to hear from me most. And it's almost like when I tell the story, it's almost like a kind of, it's like a fable. It's like a Brothers Grimm story. It feels like when I'm asked to tell the story, I feel like a sort of old man sitting around a campfire telling a fable to children.
You're like the Shakespearean town crier that comes to town and is like, gather around
to have a morality tale for you that you really need to hear.
If you want, I can go in post-production and put some periodic music behind this.
Right. So the story, and the reason why I tend to tell the Justine Sacco story more than any other is because it encapsulates the complexities of the argument better than any other public shaming story I've found. Part of the reason being that the whole world turned against Justine Sacco that night. Like, this was a shaming that everybody could get behind, from misogynists through to social justice people, through to Trump. He tweeted about it that night. So the story was that, so she's a PR woman with 170 Twitter followers, kind of Lower East Side, likes to go to bars type person. So she's on a plane journey from New York to Cape Town. So she's tweeting some pretty, I've got to say, kind of pretty obnoxious stuff about the BO of the guy sitting next to her in first class and so on. So, you know, her Twitter voice wasn't great. Then she gets to Heathrow and has a little bit of time. So tweets, going to Africa, hope I don't get AIDS. Just kidding, I'm white. And then she, you know, chuckled, got no replies. I said to her later, were you surprised that you got no replies? She said, John, I never got any replies for any of my... no one ever replied to my... She was a comedian telling bad jokes in an empty room.
Right. Like, her Twitter account is almost just like... Mm-hmm. A toy that she's playing with.
Yeah. And also, nothing like what's about to happen to her had ever happened before. So, you know, this was an innocent time. It wasn't that we weren't shaming people, but we tended to shame powerful public figures or corporations. You know, that are in the early days of Twitter shamings, we were pretty, you know, we would shame Murdoch or a fitness company that would refuse to cancel the membership of a heavily pregnant woman who had just lost her job. Like, those were the sorts of people we'd go after. But then came Justine Sacco, so with that joke. So she gets on the plane, falls asleep, wakes up at Cape Town, turns on her phone, and straight away there was a text from somebody that she hadn't spoken to since high school that said, I am so sorry to see what's happening to you right now. And so she kind of looked at this text, kind of baffled, and then her phone just blew up, including a text from her best friend saying, you need to phone me right now. You are the worldwide number one trending topic on Twitter. So what had happened was one of her 170 followers had sent her tweet to Sam Biddle, who was at the time a Gawker journalist. I think he works for The Intercept now. And he retweeted it to his 15,000 followers, and that's how the snowball happened. By the time she'd landed, she was usually Googled 40 times a month. That night she was Googled 1,220,000 times. Somebody had worked out what plane she was on, so they'd linked to a flight tracker website. There were people in bars all over New York. It was like the Truman Show. Like, just people were tweeting things like, I'm dying to go home, but I can't until Justine Sacco lands, because I'm dying to see what will happen then. Like, hashtag has Justine landed yet, which became a worldwide trending topic. It was like a kind of torture. You know, in The Men Who Stare at Goats, I write about the holy grail of torture techniques at Abu Ghraib, which is something called the Bukha effect. And it's basically startling somebody so bad that you debilitate them and then they're just putty in your hands. And that's kind of what we were all doing on Twitter that night to Justine Sacco. There were millions of people hiding because people were tweeting things like, we're about to watch this Justine Sacco bitch get fired in real time before she even knows she's being fired. Like, this was thrilling to people. People were calling it delicious that we knew what she didn't. It was like trying, convicting and sentencing a person before they even knew that they'd been arrested. Mm. And all of this was hilarious to people. And that the odd person that night who would say, like, oh, can we not just wait until the plane lands to hear her explanation for the joke? They got piled in on too. That's how hot the flame was burning. Now, as a, like, I'm a big fan of Randy Newman, so I felt that night before her plane landed that what she was attempting to do was a kind of Randy Newman type joke, making fun of her own privilege, and maybe her worst crime was that she just wasn't very good at it. And she wasn't as good as South Park or Randy Newman at that genre of humour. So I felt like I just felt like something had shifted in society. I felt similar to when Trump came down the escalator and called Mexicans rapists. It felt again like something had shifted.
Society. The energy in the room changed. Mm.
Yeah, and the world changed. And that's how I felt that night when Justine Sacco was on the plane too. It felt like something had shifted in society. Like if all of us can be that brutal, and it was a miscarriage of justice. I mean, look, I'm not saying that Justine Sacco was entirely innocent. It was like a very badly worded joke. But I think on the grand moral scale of things, it was pretty innocent. She was trying to do like My Life is Good by Randy Newman. She was mocking her own privilege by doing an exaggerated version of it.
Right.
It's a bad version of a honorable liberal comedic tradition.
Yeah, it was a terrible tweet, but then it's also the question of like, does the punishment fit the crime, where it's like,
well, the punishment didn't. I mean, you know, she's the AIDS tweet woman till she dies. She lost her job. She lost her job when she finally got a new job and Twitter found out, they tried to get her fired all over again.
Whenever I have been keeping up with like the right wing, like discourse, I hate that word, but like the discourse, capital letters, you know, cancel culture has been kind of like one of the drumbeats of the right wing discourse. And I've seen your book or your telling of the Justine Sacco situation brought up a lot in those conversations. And my immediate reaction is like, I don't know that they're really capturing John's argument here correctly.
Totally. I think my book's been sort of, to a small extent, it's been kind of weaponized by lots of people who have sort of ideological vested interests in the argument. So, for instance, when the Amy Cooper situation happened, there were people on the right who were citing my Justine Sacco story in my book as saying, well, you know, look, you know, what they're doing to Amy Cooper is just what they did to Justine Sacco, which is clearly,
you
know, a ridiculous analogy. Yeah. What Amy Cooper did was, you know, just hugely worse. But then there were other people on the left who were basically using the opposite argument. They were saying, you know, so, well, they were basically trying to compare Justine Sacco to Amy Cooper as if to imply that Justine Cooper was just as bad as Justine Sacco was just as bad as Amy Cooper. So both sides were kind of using the Justine Sacco story to justify their ideology. So I sort of felt like I had to like step in and say something. Because by then I'd become like, as my friend John Safran says, I'd become like a sort of shaming imam. Like every time somebody was shamed, like, they'd come to me I mean, sometimes the shamed people would come to me, but also sometimes just Twitter would like come to me, like, John, is this an appropriate, shaming? No, that's not how I
like, well, if you see in chapter 8 here of the Holy Book.
Yeah, from my chair on top of my mountain. Yeah, that's not how I want to spend my dotage. Adjudicating on the appropriateness of individual shamings.
Right. So let me ask you more broadly then. Like, you know, it's only been, you know, 5 years since So You've Been Publicly Shamed came out. But I mean, as somebody who watches the news every day, I will have to say it's been quite an eventful 5 years, to say the very least. You know, I'm curious, like, in our modern moment, where the nuances here between, like, what we say is cancel culture and what we say is just criticism. Because, like, for example, if some guy with, like, a swastika tattoo on his face is dogpiled online, loses his job, gets kicked to the curb, I don't know that you'd be able to find a whole lot of people that would be like, oh, that's really terrible use of, like, whatever. But there are situations that are more ambiguous. Something that I was thinking of ahead of this interview was the case of that Covington Catholic high school kid, Nicholas Sandman. So it's like, obviously in the video, he's acting, you know, in my interpretation, he's acting like a little shit. But at the end of the day, he's like, he's a 17-year-old kid, and, like, does he deserve to be, like, absolutely eviscerated online because he was just a dumb, stupid boy? Like, I don't know. I don't know. I'm curious where you think the nuances are here. And I guess what I'm really asking is, John, can you write us some permission slips?
Right. Well, I have less sympathy. I come from Britain where the media is incredibly adversarial and oppositional. And, you know, I used to write a weekly column in The Guardian where the letters page was, like, full of people saying what an asshole I was. And so I've got, like, less sympathy for public figures, columnists, and so on, who say that they're being cancelled. Mm. I wouldn't say I have, like, no sympathy for their argument at all. You know, I think there are certain circles where unpermitted thought is sort of brutally batted back. But in general, I don't have a lot of sympathy for you know, somebody who writes a very provocative column is piled in on about it on Twitter and then says that they're being cancelled. And that's partly, I guess, because I come from a culture where that's happened my whole life. Mm. You know, if you write a provocative column, you're going to get the shit kicked out of you. So that doesn't feel like a new phenomenon to me. And it certainly feels very different to what happened to Justine Sacco. Right. For instance, she was a private individual who was disproportionately punished for a badly worded liberal joke. So I suppose disproportionate punishment is something that we should think about in situations like this. Is this person getting a harsher punishment than their transgression deserves? Are they private figures or public figures? I think you can differentiate to an extent between private and public figures. Like, for instance, if I get piled in on as a public figure, I feel like I probably, you know, deserve it more than somebody with 100 Twitter followers who... Yeah, when Justine Sacco happened, people were saying, oh, well, you know, she should have known. You know, when you tweet, it's just like going to Madison Square Garden with a bullhorn. But that actually isn't true about Justine Sacco. There'd never been a situation like hers until her situation unfolded. And I don't think she could have been expected to have anticipated that would happen.
Right.
But But I suppose the main thing I want to say is, look, we're the ones with the power. Like, we wanted to remake the justice system. And in some ways, parts of the justice system did need remaking. But I think one mistake we've made is that we're throwing out some of the best stuff of the real justice system, including sentencing hearings. Like, when somebody's been convicted, we get to hear the context and we get to judge them based on a wider context and nuance of the situation. And quite often on social media, when somebody's being adjudicated, wanting to look at the context is considered a weakness. Like, we don't want to know what's happening in that person's life. You know, just look at their tweet.
Right. Because, you know, kind of the counter argument for it is that, you know, society has always enforced social and cultural norms, particularly against racism, sexism, misogyny. Well, I shouldn't say they've always enforced those norms, but it is a function of society to, like, enforce the norms within itself. And I guess the counter argument is that, you know, the same thing is happening. It's just moving to a digital space. I don't really know that I agree with that entirely. I think it's a different animal. And I think, you know, trying to understand digital spaces the same way we understand real spaces is kind of, it's like the bullhorn thing you were talking about. It's just not really comparable.
Also, you know, there was always the kind of, I think, untrue idea that the internet is not the real world. Like, what happens on Twitter is just like a game, it's like a toy. You know, for years people felt that about Twitter. It's only kind of in the last couple of years that people have stopped thinking that. So there was a sort of year zero aspect to social media shaming that was always going to end in mayhem, because, you know, you can't just remake justice from scratch without getting it wrong sometimes, without fucking it up. In the end, we're the ones, you know, the power is now in our hands, so it's kind of behooves us to kind of figure out what's the kind of ethical way of doing it.
And do you think that we've made, I guess, collectively, any progress towards that since you published the book? Do you think it's gotten any better or worse? I guess there's always a few, you know, cases we could pull out, anecdotes of different examples where this has failed or where it's been done very well.
Yeah,
right. But generally speaking,
one positive change is, as I said before, on the night of the Justine Sacco incident, if anybody stood up for her, they were then shamed. There was a woman called Helen Lewis, who's a journalist. She works for The Atlantic now. At the time, she worked for The New Statesman, and she reviewed my book. And she said she very briefly stuck her head above the parapet that night and said, are you sure that Justine Sacco deserves what she's getting? And she just got a million tweets saying, well, you're just a privileged bitch too. And so she went back down below the parapet and stopped talking. That doesn't happen anymore. The night of the Justine Sacco instance, it was like a million people yelling at one person. Now there's much more of a debate. You only have to see that. Well, with every major shaming now, you get opposing factions yelling at each other about it. If the cure for shame is empathy, then these days, if someone's shamed, And the debate around the shaming is much more democratic, less authoritarian, then that feels both better for society but also better for the mental health of the person being shamed.
So in the midst of a shaming, would you say that yelling at each other during the shaming is like a sign of progress?
I mean
that's kind of a silly way to put it, but
I do, because I think that there's less of a climate of fear around it than there used to be. people are less afraid to discuss the ambiguities. When I say people yelling at each other, what I suppose I mean is people discussing the ambiguities.
Right.
of the shaming. There's a strange, and I think basically negative consequence that's happened as a result of our overuse of public shaming, which is the fact that some shamed people are becoming like hospital superbugs. Like, there's so much shaming around that some shamed people are becoming like, are kind of mutating to become impervious to shame. Like Ralph Northam, the Virginia governor who refused to resign.
Right. Someone who I think of is like, are you familiar with Laura Loomer?
She's
just this like bumbling, just, I get secondhand embarrassment watching her like try to interrupt events or like when she handcuffed herself to Twitter. That was just so debasing and like,
I was embarrassed for her. I think.
But it's what you're talking about, right? It's like she may have been embarrassed at one point in her career or like piled on at one point in her career, but it has transformed her into having what is almost like a superpower of like not feeling shame.
Yeah. But also, I mean, yes. I mean, I don't really know enough about Laura Loomer to whether or not, you know, she's actually very vulnerable and is kind of, which is a possibility, I suppose, about her. I was thinking more, I mean, I was thinking about people like Ralph Northam who just like, no, I'm not resigning. They found photographs of him wearing blackface as a younger man, and everybody was calling for him to resign, both Democrats and Republicans, and he just refused. And it made me think, there's a line in my book where I say that if the shamed person steps out of the pact by refusing to feel ashamed, then the whole thing crumbles. And I think more and more people are doing that. And I think in some circumstances that's good. Like, if it's an unfair shaming and you stick up for yourself, like Justin Sacco just did what everybody used to do when they were being shamed, which is like apologize as profusely as possible and then just retreat as quickly as you can, even if you didn't think you'd done anything wrong. So sometimes people refusing to be ashamed is a positive step, but very often it's negative, because if you refuse to feel remorse, you refuse to feel ashamed, you refuse to take consequences for your actions, then, you know, those are all items on the psychopath checklist. It's as if our overuse of shame is making people behave more like psychopaths to survive. And, you know, we don't want that.
Right. So we certainly still have a long way to go. But I think, you know, the stories that you tell in the book, it's like always, especially as like the, what do we say, the temperature in the room, or, you know, I feel like things are kind of rearranging again right now.
Yeah.
You know, it's in any era or moment where things are rearranging, I always feel like is a good spot to kind of, you know, practice some retrospection or like to kind of think about how have we been acting these last few years? How can we be better? Whatever.
Right. Yeah. In Shamed, I described it as Twitter sometimes feeling like toddlers crawling towards a gun. And I don't think that's true anymore. Right, 5 years later, I don't see Twitter as being like toddlers crawling towards a gun. It's much more like young people still sometimes fucking up, but at least trying to look at it more deeply. So I think in general I think there has been some progress.
Yeah, I think part of that is also just the way that we understand social media's interaction with our real lives, I think, is maturing a bit too.
I might be slightly biased because when Trump got elected, I was always kind of a sort of moderate left-wing person. But after Trump got elected, I was just so horrified by that development that I found myself becoming more and more left-wing. So it's possible that my attitude has slightly changed as a result of
Right.
Living under Trump.
I've been in conversation with John Ronson. He's a acclaimed journalist and author of some of my favorite books. So if you like this show, you'll definitely like his work. In the description of this episode, I'll include a link to where you can find some of that, where you can follow John on Twitter, all that good stuff. But John, this is the show it is, after all. So there's one more question I have to ask you, which is, what is your favorite thing on the internet right now?
Since the pandemic happened, the two things I became really interested in, like I had to have some pastimes to get me through lockdown. So I became very interested in birds. I put a bird table outside my window and I stare all day at the birds and, you know, look them up, Google them and find out what type of birds they are. And I also got really interested in a British post-punk band called The Fall, F-A-L-L. It's like, imagine if Captain Beefheart had been a dock worker in the north of England in the late 1970s, and I'd listened to a lot of the Sex Pistols. That's basically The Fall. And there's a site called The Annotated Fall, where every single one of the thousands of songs he wrote, like, he was incredibly prolific, Marquis Smith, is there, are then like debated and pulled apart, like, what's the meaning of this? What does he mean by that? And quite often, like, when I finish work for the day, I'll listen to a Fall song, then I'll go on The Annotated Fall and read the different interpretations of what the song meant. It's such a strange, fun rabbit hole to go down.
Yeah, I was going to say, earlier in our conversation, we were just talking about, you know, you said something you've been interested in is just how effortless it is to fall into a rabbit hole. But that's a very wholesome one to fall in, so I can't raise too much issue with that, I guess.
It's my rabbit hole. It's not entirely wholesome because I've made the mistake. The Fall had about 50 or 60 members over the years. He kept on firing everyone and getting you, which means that, like, everywhere you look, there's somebody who used to be in The Fall. And I follow some of them on Twitter, and sometimes I over-infuse, and I can tell that they think I'm a little bit odd, like I'm too into them. so I've stopped doing that now. I've stopped doing that now because I was embarrassing myself by sort of saying, so in this song, what did this mean? And they're sort of slightly treating me like, like with kid gloves, like, okay, John, you can calm down. But yeah, The Annotated Fall is what I recommend that you just listen to a Fall song at random, and there's like 1,000 to choose from, and then go on The Annotated Fall and figure out what the song means.